Asit.
Asit.
There was.
Puranjana.
Paranjana.
Nama.
Named.
Raja.
King.
Rajan.
O king.
Rahat Shravaha.
Whose activities were great.
Tasha.
His.
Avigyata.
The unknown one.
Nama.
Of the name.
Asit.
There was.
Sukha.
Friend.
Avigyata.
Unknown.
Cheshtitaha.
Whose activities? Translation. My dear king, once in the past lived a king named Puranjana, who was celebrated for his great activities. He had a friend named Avigyata, the unknown one. No one could understand the activities of Avigyata. So you can repeat, my dear king.
Once in the past
lived a king named Puranjana, who was celebrated for his great activities.
He had a friend named
Avigyata,
the unknown one.
No one could understand the activities of
Avigyata.
Purport by His Divine Grace, Śrīla Prabhupāda, Śrīla Prabhupāda Ki Jai. Every living entity is Puranjana. The word Puram means within this body, within this form, and Jana means living entity. Actually, another thing Puram means is like a town. That's another definition of the word. Anyway, thus everyone is Puranjana. Every living entity is supposed to be the king of his body, because the living entity is given full freedom to use his body as he likes. He usually engages his body for sense gratification because one who is in the bodily conception of life feels that the ultimate goal of life is to serve the senses. This is the process of karma, kanda. One who has no inner knowledge, who does not know that he is actually the spirit soul living within the body, who is simply enamored by the dictation of the senses, is called a materialist. A materialistic person interested in sense gratification can be called a Puranjana. Because such a materialistic person, the reason I'm laughing is because Prabhupada gave the name Puranjana to one particular devotee. Puranjana Das, you know, just, anyway. Because, just to give you a little indication of what was going through my mind, because such a materialistic person utilizes his senses according to his whims, he may also be called a king. An irresponsible king takes the royal position to be his personal property and misuses his treasury for sense gratification. The word Brahat Shravaha is also significant. The word Shravaha means fame. The living entity is famous from ancient times, for as stated in Bhagavad Gita in the second chapter, text 20, the Jayate Mriyate Va. The living entity is never born and never dies. Because he is eternal, his activities are eternal, although they are performed in different types of bodies. Mahanyate Hanya Mane Sharire. He does not die even after the annihilation of the body. Thus, the living entity transmigrates from one body to another and performs various activities. In each body, the living entity performs so many acts. Sometimes he becomes a great hero, just like Hiranyakashipu and Kamsa, or in the modern age, Napoleon or Hitler. The activities of such men are certainly very great, but as soon as their bodies are finished, everything else is finished. Then they remain in name only. Therefore, a living entity may be called Brahatshavaha. He may have a great reputation for various types of activities. Nonetheless, he has a friend whom he does not know. Materialistic persons do not understand that God is present as the Supersoul, who is situated within the heart of every living entity. Although the Paramatma sits besides the Jivatma as a friend, the Jivatma or living entity does not know it. Consequently, he is described as Avigyata Sakha, meaning one who has an unknown friend. The word Abhigata Cheshtataha is also significant because a living entity works hard under the direction of the Paramatma and is carried away by the laws of nature. Nonetheless, he thinks himself independent of God and independent of the stringent laws of material nature. It is stated in the Bhagavad Gita in the second chapter, text 24, Achedyo yam adajo yam akledyo shosha hevacha nitya sarvagata stanur achalo yam sanatanaha. This individual's soul is unbreakable and insoluble and can be neither burned nor dried. He is everlasting, all-pervading, unchangeable, immovable, and eternally the same. The living entity is sanatana, eternal, because he cannot be killed by any weapon, burnt into ashes by fire, soaked or moistened by water, nor dried up by air. He is considered to be immune to material reactions. Although he is changing bodies, he is not affected by the material conditions. He is placed under the material conditions and he acts according to the directions of his friend, the Supersoul. As stated in Bhagavad Gita in the 15th chapter, text 15, Sarvashacham Riti Sanavishto Matakshmatir Yanamapohanam Cha. I am seated in everyone's heart, and from me come remembrance, knowledge, and forgetfulness. Thus, the Lord is Paramatma, is situated in everyone's heart, and he gives directions to the living entity to act in whatever way the living entity desires. In this life and in the previous lives, the living entity does not know that the Lord is giving him a chance to fulfill all kinds of desires. No one can fulfill any desire without the sanction of the Lord. All the facilities given by the Lord are unknown to the conditioned soul. So, Asit Puranjano Nama Raja Ranjan Brahatshavaha Dashavigata Namasit Sokhavigata Cheshtitaha. So Omaganata Madandasha Gunanjana Shlakaya Chakshuran Meditam Gena Tasmai Shigurave Namaha. So here, basically, the ontology of the soul, the ontology of the super soul, and the ontology of the material energy is being described. There's a lot of information. This is jnana. You understand jnana. Just like Bhagavad Gita, in the Bhagavad Gita, we have the Bhagavad Gita divided up into three different categories in terms of different chapters. Did you know this? The Bhagavad Gita is 6, 6, and 6. There's 18 chapters in Bhagavad Gita. And the first six are generally dedicated to what's called karma yoga. And the last six, I mean, I know there's verses that are exceptions in this, like manmanabhavamad bhakto, that which is a devotional verse, obviously. But the last six verses, last six chapters, are generally the jnana yoga. And the middle six chapters are bhakti yoga. For example, you end the first six chapters with the description of the yoga system. That's the sixth chapter itself, where Krishna describes hatha yoga and controlling the mind. And Arjuna says it's very difficult to control the mind. It's more difficult than controlling the wind. And then finally, at the end of the sixth chapter, you have a verse that leads in to the bhakti yoga section of the Gita, and that's, of course, yoginamapi sarvesham, madgatena antaratmana shradabham, bhajate yomam, sarame yuktatabho mataha, where Krishna says, of all yogis, the bhakti yogi, or one who loves me, is considered to be the highest yogi. Yoginam api sarvesham, that means of all yogis, madgatena antaratmana, one who is actually taking me as the goal of life. Gatain or Gati, I'll give you the literal translation, not so much what the translation is in the Gita. Antaratmana, as his very self, like antar means within, atma, and then you have reference to the super soul again, antaratmana, and worships me shradavan with great faith, bhajate yomam, offerings, worship me with great faith. Asame yuktatamo mataha. I am considering to be the highest type of person. It's anyway. So that's how the first six chapters ends. And then you have the Bhakti Yoga section, which is the middle six chapters, which is considered to be like the cream. It's like a sandwich. Sometimes it's described like a sandwich that you have the bread on the outside, but really what you're interested in is what's in the inside. Or even to be more explicit, when we were young, we would eat these cookies called Oreo cookies. I don't know if anyone's eaten an Oreo cookie. But the Oreo cookie is cream-filled in the middle, and the outside is, well, not so bad, you know. It's also kind of nice. But it's not as nice as the center. So, anyway, so even when you're eating sandwiches, sometimes you just sort of eat the crust first so you can get to the center, which has it, because the crust is not so enjoyable. So, anyway, so after you finish the middle six chapters, then you get to the jnana section. And this is really what's being dealt with here. Jnana. And I want to read a little bit from the Bhagavad Gita in this respect, in this context, from the 13th chapter, which comes after the 12th chapter, which is one of the middle six chapters. And this 13th chapter specifically deals with the subject matter that we're talking about here, which is the soul, the super soul, and the field of activities, which happens to be the body. This is our field of activities. It's interesting that we think, just in one side note, that we actually think we're experiencing this world, but actually all we're experiencing is the interactions of this body. We're not actually experiencing the world. Our perception of the world is extremely indirect. If I touch this piece of wood, first of all, it's not me touching the piece of wood. That doesn't mean I'm psychotic. You know, it's not me. This is not me. You know, if you tell that, actually, if you tell that to a psychologist, they say that this is not me, he'll probably think that you're crazy. So this hand hits the piece of wood, and what's happening is that there's little sensors in the fingers, and actually all over the skin, that sense the pressure that you're putting on, and sense this, whether something is soft or hard. It's like I was reading a book by Helen Keller the other day. Anyone's heard of Helen Keller? Mm-hmm. Very interesting personality. She was born blind and, not born, but she became blind and deaf. And so basically the only communication she had with the world was the sense of touch. She said she was describing how her hands are like her eyes and how she perceives different things in terms of the forms and the textures and the pressure and everything like that. And somehow or other, she was able to learn how to talk and communicate utilizing, you know, the sense of touch. Quite interesting. So anyway, so we're touching and we're sensing different things about this piece of wood. And so there's some stimuli that are being transmitted through the nervous system. Of course, the consciousness is circulating all over, and the blood supply is described by the Vedic literatures. And so then it goes up to the brain. We're not denying that people have a brain. The brain and the mind are two different things, incidentally. They're not the same thing. So it goes to the brain, and somehow or other, then the consciousness becomes transmitted or through the blood or through the nervous system to the soul and the heart. So it's a very indirect thing. So the soul is basically experiencing the interactions of the body, not the external world so much, or it's a very indirect experience of the external world. For example, if you cut off the nerves, you have no ability to experience the external world. Your hand is numb. I mean, sometimes we're sitting in one position for one time, and our foot becomes numb, or our leg becomes numb. Like when we're sitting in chanting japa, we have to keep adjusting. I don't know if all of you have that experience, but I do. That's why I can't sit in one position for very long, because after a while, what they say, my foot falls asleep. It's not that a foot actually goes to sleep. and start snoring or something like that. But the foot, you lose sensation of the foot because the blood supply gets cut. And, you know, the blood is the carrier of consciousness. So in other words, you're just experiencing what's happening inside the body. You're not really experiencing the outside world because it's indirect. Just like, I'll give you an example. If we're playing a television program right now, let's say the Ed Sullivan Show or something. Anyway, none of you know what that is. Or MTV. That's from the old days. Let's say you have MTV, right? And so what you're experiencing, your direct experience is not what's happening there on the stage, in the studio, wherever the MTV thing is happening. You're experiencing, or the body's experiencing, sorry, a bunch of electrons or whatever LEDs or whatever they use for televisions right now. You're experiencing what's happening right here. And due to illusion, you think you're experiencing something that's happening somewhere else. You're getting information about what's happening somewhere else, but your direct experience is not of that particular thing. Although you're an illusion, you are thinking you're experiencing it. Do you follow? You know, just like I say, I'm watching Father Knows Best. What's the name of a TV program nowadays? Nobody knows. I'm watching Star Wars. What? What?
How I Met Your Mother.
How I Met Your Mother. Is that a horror story or something like that? Anyway, the Addams Family or something like that. So, oh my God, I'll have bad dreams about this one. So whatever you're watching, you're thinking, you know, I'm watching, How I Met Your Mother. But you're not. You're just watching this, right? Or the body is just watching, to be more precise. And you know, some electrons, photons are coming off of the screen, hitting your eyeballs, not hitting the eyeballs, going through the lens. If there are such things as photons, which we're not actually sure about anyway, whether photons are particles or energy, and somehow or other, and then the optic nerve and all that other stuff. So basically, you're not experiencing it. You're experiencing... And because if you change the nature of the senses, your experience changes. If you have a different type of body, you experience things differently. Or your interpretation of what you're experiencing is different. Isn't it? All right, so enough on that. So basically, the point I'm making is your field of activities is this body, within the body. And, you know, based upon what the body happens to the body, you have certain experiences and you can control the body to do certain things, etc. So that's why the body is called the field of activities, the kshetra. And you're called the kshetragya. It means the knower of the field. But actually, and that's another interesting point, because you're not a true knower of the field unless you're Krishna conscious. In one sense, you can be called the knower of the field in one context, because basically you're experiencing the body. But you don't really know what the field is unless you're Krishna conscious. Does that follow? And basically, Krishna is always the knower of this field, and he's the knower of all fields. Anyway, we'll read about this in the Bhagavad Gita. Let's read about it. So the chapter begins with a question where Arjuna asks Krishna. He said, Krishna, I want to know about Prakriti, nature, Purusha, the enjoyer, and the field, and the knower of the field. And so that's, the field is this body, and the knower of the field is, you know, both you and the super soul, etc. So the Supreme Personality of God has said, this body, O son of Kunti, is called the field. And one who knows this body is called the knower of the field. And so the next text is interesting, too, in this regard, where Krishna says, O son of Sayana Bharata, you should understand that I am also the knower in all bodies, in addition to the individual soul, Krishna is saying, and to understand this body and its knower is called knowledge. So Krishna here is describing, this chapter is very interesting. This is all, of course, this is all jnana. It's jnana. You know, what is the material nature? Who is the enjoyer of the nature? What is the field? Who is the knower of the field? What is knowledge? And what is the object of knowledge? So anyway, it's very easy. It's actually quite an easy chapter to understand. Sometimes devotees get bewildered with this chapter. It's one of the shortest chapters in the Gita. So Krishna says, to understand this body and its knower is called knowledge. In other words, to understand the soul, the body, the interactions, and also the super soul is called knowledge. And Krishna says, that is my opinion. It's a good opinion. And then, anyway, there's some interesting information. We're not going to go through the whole chapter of the Gita about the interactions of the prakriti. So then there's more description about the super soul later on in the chapter, beginning with text 14, where Krishna says, everywhere are his hands and legs, his eyes and heads and faces, and he has ears everywhere. In this way, the super soul exists pervading everything. The super soul is the original source of all senses, yet he is without senses. Now this is indicating material senses. He's out without material senses. He is unattached, although he is the maintainer of all living beings. He transcends the modes of nature, and at the same time, he is the master of all the modes of nature. The supreme truth exists outside and inside of all living beings, the moving and non-moving. Because he is subtle, he is beyond the power of the material senses to see or know. Although far, far away, he is also near to all. Although the supersoul appears to be divided among all beings, he is never divided. He is situated as one. Although he is the maintainer of every living entity, it is to be understood that he devours and develops all. He is the source of light in all luminous objects. He is beyond the darkness of matter and unmanifested. He is knowledge. He is the object of knowledge. He is the goal of knowledge. He is situated in everyone's heart. So that's a brief description of who the super soul is. So when you talk about the super soul, at least today, we're going to talk about defining the super soul or understanding the super soul in terms of ontology, teleology, and functionally, the three different categories. Does everyone understand those words? Ontology basically means who he is. Teleology means why is he doing what he's doing, and functionally means what does he do? So it's important to understand the super soul from three different angles. So first of all, the super soul is Krishna. Advaita Chuta Nadi Rananta Rupa Madhyam Purana Purusham Navayovanam Cha. There are no two gods, although sometimes you go to a Hindu temple, they describe the gods. But there's only one God. And the super soul is a portion of a plenary portion of the Supreme Lord. That doesn't mean he's less than the Supreme Lord. It just means he exhibits less qualities than Krishna in Goloka Vrindavan. Specifically, he doesn't exhibit the quality of intimate loving exchanges that you have in Goloka Vrindavan, where the devotee can actually chastise the Supreme Lord or become the lover of the Supreme Lord or become the friend in an intimate sense of the Supreme Lord. With the super soul, it's more or less that he's worshipped with reverence. Although it's described as sakha here in this verse, he's your friend. He's your friend, not in the sense that you put your arm around the super soul and you say, hey, buddy. He's the friend in the sense that he's looking out for your interests. It's like an older friend. Just like in Krishna's pastimes, you have older friends, equal friends, and younger friends. And then you have Priya Sakas, Priya Narmada Sakas. Anyway, you have dear friends, most dear friends, etc., like that. So in this particular case, he's like an uncle more. Uncle Super Soul. Or grandfather. Although he's your father. So he's concerned with you. He loves you. He's seated in your heart, just like the Upanishads describe, like two birds seated on the same tree, and he's just watching you, waiting for you to turn back to him, watching you eat the fruits on the tree. So it's described in the Gita, we just read a verse, that he's not divided, although he appears divided. The example given sometimes in the Vedic literatures is like the reflection of the sun or the moon on different bodies of water. Sometimes we'll say, look at the sun or look at the moon on the lake. But the moon is not on the lake. The moon is actually situated many millions of miles away, as is the sun. So still, but his presence is manifest in that particular location. So the presence of the Supersoul is manifest in the heart, but the Supersoul never comes in contact with matter. In other words, he's not material. He's not touching the ventricles and the auricles in the heart, and he's not swimming in the blood. He's transcendentally situated. That's very important to understand. So his presence is manifest in the heart. And it's not just manifest in terms of an image. It's manifested functionally. So anyway, so that's the ontological position. Let's go back. He's Krishna. He's always situated spiritually. Let's see, another aspect of ontology. Yeah, he's omniscient. He's seen everything. Omnipresent, we already said. That means he's manifested everywhere, even within every atom. He's all-powerful. All the different qualities of God. And he's also very attractive. Mm-hmm. Many times, yogis, they'll meditate, and they'll see Super Soul of the heart, and they'll think, that's me. I mean, it'd be really nice. You know, you look in the mirror sometimes and you see, like, who would be a handsome person? John Wayne or something, anyway, or whoever. I don't know any handsome people nowadays. I haven't watched too many movies. So if you look in the mirror and all of a sudden, let's say all of a sudden, you look in the mirror and you see the most beautiful lady imaginable, or a man, if you happen to be a man, you know. If you were a man and you saw a picture of a lady, you'd freak out. But anyway. But you can imagine. So it would just like you get sick. Look in the mirror. Wow. You'd feel really proud. So the heart is described like a mirror. So the yogi's looking in the heart. You know, like that. He's looking in the heart, and all of a sudden he sees this attractive forearm personality there. And he thinks, wow. I'm God. You know, I'm pretty. I'm whatever I am. So that's what happens. So the Super Soul is very attractive. So that's the ontological position. So let's get to the point of... let's see. Teleology. We could do teleology. Or we can do functional. Let's do functional first, because then teleology follows. So functional, what does he do? You know, why is he situated in everyone's heart and in every atom? Because he's taking the function of providing intelligence, and not only intelligence, but also energy, intelligence, remembrance, and forgetfulness, according to the Gita in the 15th chapter, right? Matak smritir gyanam apoanam cha. Because why does he do that? He does that because he's given the living entities independence, free will, and in order for the living entities to properly exercise their free will, they have to have the intelligence in how to do it. Or they have to be able to forget God if they want to forget God. So forgetfulness is important. Or they have to be able to function in terms of a particular type of body. It's like in science they call innate ability to function of a living entity, they call that instinct. Right? Instinct. That means inside understanding or something like that. Instinct. So that's how they explain, let's say, the ability of birds to fly all the way from the North Pole to, you know, South America every year. I mean, it's amazing. Or not only birds, but they have the butterflies who fly to Mexico every winter. What are they, monarch butterflies, some type of butterflies. And it's amazing. They have all these instincts how to do things, and nobody's ever taught them. I mean, it's not. Sometimes they emulate their parents, but sometimes they don't have parents, and they learn how to do it anyway. I mean, just like people have all these desires, like eating and sex and everything like that. And usually you don't have to go to school for things like that. It's just an instinctual thing, how to do something. So that instinct, Prabhupada describes those instincts to do certain things or function in a certain way, come from the super soul. It's not just simply a mechanistic thing programmed in the genes. It may be also in the genes, in the DNA and RNA and stuff like that. But that super soul who programs it, you know, who has programmed the genes? It's like if you have a computer, who has programmed the computer? No computer has ever programmed itself. Of course, they do have computers, computer programs that can program other programs, but the original program was always programmed by a person. It's not that computers came about by chance. And then one day you just like woke up in the morning and there was the latest iteration of Windows, Windows 7, you know. You know, Windows 7, 64-bit. None of you know what that means. Anyway, so it's not the latest version of Windows happened just because it evolved from Windows XP. You know, Windows XP evolved into, you know, Windows 7. Windows 7 is now evolving through natural selection. You know, people buying computers that are better than other computers with different features. And so, no, I mean, obviously someone programmed it. Yeah, not someone. There's probably 10,000 or more programmers sitting in little booths at Microsoft. You know, little nerds, or big nerds, high paid nerds just sitting and programming the computers, right? Isn't it? So anyway, so Super Soul is doing all that programming of the DNA, RNA, and then the atom and all that other stuff like that, just keeping everything going. And giving intelligence according to people's desires. So that's his function. And then as far as the teleology, that means the purpose of it all, is to allow us to have free will to experience all the varieties of our desires and ultimately come to the point of turning back to the super soul. And when you turn back to the super soul, another function he has, after you turn back to the super soul, is he brings you a spiritual master. Ramanda Ramate Kona Bhagavan Jeev Guru Krishna Prasadi Bhai Bhakti Glata Bish. That when you're ready, you just pray to Super Soul. Actually, Super Soul also gives inspiration for another thing, because we have very little time left, for like scientific advancement. I was just thinking about this person, Archimedes. You know Archimedes? He was figuring out how to weigh something in the water. And anyway, it was a. Somehow or other, he was sitting in his bathtub, isn't it? And then he understood that, you know, that when you go into the water, you displace an equal amount of space of your whole body. And so, but he had that inspiration. So science usually proceeds by inspiration. Even Einstein experienced that too. So anyway, so teleology, real quickly, means the super soul gives us the ability to function within this mature world so we can ultimately turn back to him. And then he sends us our spiritual master, who is the manifest representative of super soul, who is understood in Christian theology as a member of the Trinity, Father, Son, and Holy Ghost. Actually, the original word for ghost in Aramaic is not ghost, it's spirit. It's interesting they call it the Father, Son, and Holy Ghost. But it's the Father, Son, and Super Soul. The Father, the Guru, and the Super Soul. To make it clear, right? So it's easy to understand. Okay, all glories to Srila Prabhupada. Srila Prabhupada, Ki Jai. Radha Lokananda, Ki Jai.